I'm Adam Voley.
And I'm Joe Martin. We're here to ask each other one very simple question about Star Wars Rogue One.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
I was not, and I'm really about at the end of my rope with Disney's restarting of the Star Wars franchise. First, you had the new Star Wars, which, if you take away the fact that the Xerox machine should have a title credit, was an enjoyable movie, but Rogue One failed for me on almost every level. I will say that it had good ideas. At the heart of it, you see why people thought this would be a good story and a worthy installment in the franchise. But it's also very clear that from the story planning session to the big screen, a lot of bad choices were made, and I am willing to complain about them at length. How about yourself?
I agree. I absolutely agree that the copy machine needs a credit both for The Force Awakens and for Rogue One. Both movies seem to lean heavily on that feeling of love that you have for the existing Star Wars movies without actually working to carve out their own place in the Star Wars universe. And beyond that, I will say for Rogue One, I spent most of the movie confused about what was going on and why it was going on. And I don't feel like they did a good job of setting up what exactly was happening in this movie or why it was happening.
Really? I was never confused about what was happening, or at least what I believed the people were. I was never confused about what I thought was happening and why it was happening. I just thought it wasn't set up in such a way that I could actually feel emotion about it. I wasn't confused about the story. I was just bored. But yeah, let's start with the general concepts, because it seems like, and this, to be fair, isn't entirely Disney's fault. Even when George Lucas got a handle on it again, he did the same thing. To the producers, Star Wars seems to be this set of plot elements that you mix and rearrange and apply a fresh coat of paint to, and then put out in a different arrangement, from your Death Star or other super weapon to your fighter search or search for the weak point, the finding of plans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was never done as blatantly as in the first sequel. But at this point, I feel like I could write a Star Wars movie without really having to think about it.
Yeah, you mix in your battle on a base, you mix in your space battle above, you mix in some interpersonal problems between one or more characters, and you call it a day.
Pretty much. And I don't think that's laziness. Lord knows, no one in that movie isn't working. It's just that, it's just fear. It's an unwillingness to go beyond a certain formula.
Right, these are the movies that have been popular, these are the movies that have made millions, or is it billions by this point? Mm-hmm. This is what's popular, why step off and take a risk by making something completely different?
Right, Disney is bound and determined to get back its investment. And how much did they pay for Star Wars again? I can't remember, it was a lot of money. Billions, I know.
Definitely billions.
All right. Well, let's start with the general concepts that are unique to this movie. Now, as far as a jumping off point goes, I thought that the battle that's described in the opening crawl of Episode 4, the first victory of the rebellion, was a perfectly good setting. And I also liked the whole suicide mission idea. These are the heroes who have made the victory over evil possible. These are the people who don't get sung about at the end, but they made the difference. I think that's a romantic and even brave concept for a Star Wars film, to kill off all of your characters by the end.
Yeah, I agree. That point was interesting, was unexpected, or at least would have been had my daughter not spoiled it, thanks to her friends at school. that point I did like. I would say almost everything else about the movie I didn't, and I would agree with you. I don't think this movie gave me a reason to care, such that when everyone died by the end of the movie, it didn't really emotionally impact me at all. But as far as a storytelling choice, I thought it was a good one.
I also liked the idea of, it's not a plot hole, but of giving an explanation for why the Death Star had that glaring weakness in the very first movie. It's not a problem that the weakness existed in the first place. You accept this sort of storytelling choice, but if it's there, then you can use it. And I thought that having a secret rebel engineer design it in the first place was a clever way of tying things in.
I agree on that. I think the big plot point was in the original Star Wars movie, where you had this weakness that was completely unexplained, but oh so very convenient. The space station, the evil empire's ultimate trillion, quadrillion dollar space station, has a very convenient self-destruct button. All you have to do is launch a small torpedo into it, and the whole thing ends. Was a big plot hole in the original movie, and I do give Rogue One a lot of credit for closing that plot hole in a way that makes a lot of sense and doesn't introduce too many questions of its own.
Beyond that, and here, okay, so those are ideas that I think worked, and that you could have built a solid script around. And as far as those go, I think another one that was half-baked and never really comes out is this tension between rebels of different stripes. I think it's clear that Forrest Whitaker's character, and to some extent the supporting character, whose name I can't remember. And let me just say that since so many of these characters are completely forgettable, I am going to have a lot of trouble remembering names. If the story were more interesting, this wouldn't be difficult for me. I should open up a cast list right now. I think I'm going to do that. But if
I actually did that before we started talking, had a cast list from IMDb open and was scanning down the list of names thinking, I don't know who any of these people are or what they did in the movie.
All right. Diego Luna's character, Cassian Andor, the assassin that Jyn Erso teams up with.
Yes.
There's this tension between the rebels who are much like who are cast in the mold of the original movies, who are this honorable opposition, and these terrorists who are willing to do anything it takes to overcome the Empire. And I thought that as a background element, that was interesting. That was fun. I have spoken with some people who feel like it's a clash in tone with Star Wars in general, that's just not something they want to see in a Star Wars film, that Star Wars should be more escapist than that. Your mileage may vary.
I don't really have a problem with having a split in the rebellion. My complaint was more, as the movie started, and this goes back to what I said earlier about confusion, as the movie started and as the movie kept going, I was unclear on exactly what the divisions in the Rebel Command were or what the divisions were about. I heard characters saying that Saw Gerrera was a terrorist and a fanatic, but it was pretty much, from my memory, limited to just those statements. He's a terrorist. He's a fanatic. We can't trust him. He's doing his own thing. He's a terrorist. He's a fanatic. He's violent. You can't deal with him. You can't reason with him. But it was never really clear what it was that he wanted that was separate from what everyone else wanted.
Right.
How it was that his tactics actually differed from everyone else. Was he going around planting bombs and blowing up buildings in civilian areas and accepting civilian deaths? Was he strafing Imperial planets and just causing mass death? Or was he just using more brutal battle tactics? That was never really made clear.
Right. The only person who ever engages in dirty trickery on behalf of the rebellion in the story is actually a member of the Rebel Alliance. It's Diego Luna's carrier, Cassian.
Yes. Yes, very much so. And I felt like I wanted at least a little bit more explanation of why we were supposed to be afraid of or distrust Saw Gerrera, rather than just... I felt like the movie was telling me and wasn't showing me.
That's an excellent point. It's an old Saw from writers, but there is more power. There is power, period. There's no power in telling someone something. Details are only effective if you illustrate them. You can say that Saw is a bad guy, but unless we see it or are given an example of it, it's practically meaningless.
Yes, and I've since done some research and found out that Saw Gerrera's backstory is explained a little bit more fully on the ongoing animated show on Disney, Star Wars Rebels. But I have a fundamental problem. I had this problem with the Star Trek reboot when it came out, and I have this problem with Star Wars. I don't think a movie should be relying on external sources for its backstory. A movie, by its very nature, is going to have a bigger, broader audience who are completely unfamiliar with the external elements. And if you're hoping that your audience has familiarity with those sources, I feel like that makes it a weaker movie.
Sure, and I think it's giving them too much credit to think that they actually intend for us to go read those books anyway. No, I think it's just a bad screenplay.
I would tend to agree. The fact that he has a more in-depth backstory elsewhere should not preclude filling in his character in this particular story.
Really, the problem with Saw is the same as the problem with so many characters, which is that they aren't there to inform the story. Saw doesn't play into a particular theme. He doesn't inform Jyn Erso's character arc, which she doesn't really have. He is the person in the place that she has to find to get the thing.
Yeah, he is the MacGuffin who is holding the MacGuffin.
And that, exactly. And that's pretty much the story in a nutshell.
Actually, now that I've said that, this movie is MacGuffins all the way down. There is the rebel soldier who has the MacGuffin message from the MacGuffin dad about the MacGuffin plans, who is held by the MacGuffin rebel split leader, whom everyone must track down as they unnest these nesting dolls.
Right. It's all just dots on a plot arc. It's as dry as a map. That's what's really made me bored throughout this movie. You can name any character, but I defy you to really explain their cogent arc. Cassian Andor, for example, does not shoot the designer of the Death Star. Why does he not shoot? Obviously, this is a turning point for him. Does he not shoot Galen Erso because he has feelings for Jyn? Does he not shoot him because Jyn said something that affected him? In which case, what? Because it's not in the script. Is he just sick of the killing? In which case, why didn't we see him unhappy or pained about having killed the snitch on the earlier planet? It's just a completely unexplained decision. And Jyn Erso, despite being the leader, is really no better. She doesn't start the story with a problem or a dilemma. The whole backstory in which her father is dragged away doesn't seem to greatly inform the character. She wants to find her father because he's her father. And then, okay, fair play. She's mad because her father is killed. But that doesn't explain the rallying cause for hope later on. What has she learned in the interim that makes her such a fount of highfalutin inspiring oratory. There are no answers to any of these questions as far as I can tell.
Jen Erso's character in particular is very interesting, and the rebellions are built on Hope line, despite being highly hyped in the trailer, is not actually her line. She is repeating a line from Cassian Andor earlier in the film. But I don't think it's ever really explained why it is that she buys into the rebellion. We see her at the beginning of the movie, and she's in Imperial custody, and we very much get the feeling she is some kind of criminal lowlife of some sort, living outside the law. She was raised by Saw Gerrera, but ended up leaving him, striking out on her own for reasons that I'm not entirely clear on, and then has been knocking around, getting in trouble on the wrong side of the law. They want her help finding her father, which really I'm not sure why she would be any more help than anyone else would be. But you're right. Then just 90 minutes later, 60 minutes later, she's espousing, bring down the Empire, have hope, lead a rebellion. And I'm unclear really why. You know, is she meant to be a Han Solo type, heart of gold, goes from good to bad, help the good guys? But it's never really explained what triggers that change. Why doesn't she just leave once her father is dead?
Just as strange as the rebellion's turn of heart. They refuse to go on the mission that she wants them to go on, and then after learning that she's gone on it anyway, are again suddenly filled with zealous gusto for the cause and can't help but go join the battle.
Yeah, there seems to be this weird feeling of we've got a ship and 15 individuals who are fighting, therefore we must scramble the entire fleet to go join the battle, which is both a tactical and strategic decision, doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Maybe it's a musketeer thing, all for one and one for all. If in for a penny, in for a pound. I'm sure if I keep talking, I can come up with more cliches.
Yeah, and again, it's another thing that could make for good element of the script had they not spent the previous 20 minutes blowing it up by demonstrating that the Rebel Alliance was more rebel than alliance and didn't seem to have any loyalty to each other at all.
Mm-hmm. And those are character moments that aren't set up properly or earned. There are other character arcs that seem to begin but never land. I saw in your notes a little while back that you were curious as to what the point of the blind character, Baze Malbus, I believe?
Yes.
The Force student was, and what the point of his partner was. That was something, that was another concept I found interesting. I thought the idea of a person who was a follower of the Force religion, if you will, but clearly did not possess Force power or had no Jedi to teach him how to use it and was resorting to monk-like chants and the like while just honing his natural skill was interesting. But at the end, you can – it's so weird. I see how this could have come off, and yet it's not what happened, and I have no explanation for it. At the very end, there's this battle. There's this great fight. And he makes his way through the firefight, despite being blind, and manages to pull a switch before being gunned down. It's not, I suppose it was supposed to be the Force leading him, but I don't think it was explicit enough. I think really he needed to be shot halfway down to reach out and then in one triumphant moment to successfully pull that switch with the Force.
Yeah.
And then there you go. You've got his faith finally rewarding him at the last moment. And then if you make his friend a skeptic who watches this happen as he does in the film, and that somehow leads to a change of heart just before he dies, then you have kind of a beautiful moment, I think. But again, as it was filmed, that's just not what happens. It's a interesting character concept who dies.
Right. And again, it's interesting characters that seemingly come out of nowhere. They do their stuff. They roll off the screen. And we're not really sure why they're there, other than contributing the climactic pull of the switch, which really could have been anyone. Why does it have to be them? What is it they're bringing to the story? And am I bothered by the fact that we're shown he has some kind of devotion to the Force religion, but it's never clear whether he actually has any connection to the Force. And I think we're meant to believe that he does, either that or he's just insanely lucky and talented as a blind man. But I think we're meant to infer from the fact that he's blind and the fact that he's extremely capable that he does have some kind of connection to the Force. But then that brings up, if he is able to walk through a storm of blaster bolts, reach the control panel and pull the switch, why does it suddenly fail him? Why is he gunned down at that point in that way?
Right.
And as to your point, that if he'd reached out with the Force and triggered the switch, and that prompts his friend the skeptic to switch from skeptic to believer, that makes sense. But in that the Force suddenly fails him and he's gunned down, and his friend the skeptic picks up the religion, doesn't to me make any sense at all.
Well, I can see where you go from that, though. Again, this is my frustration. Usually, movies are not very few movies that I've watched have been movies that I see as being completely inept from word one. Usually, there are clearly threads in place, and they didn't get followed for whatever reason. And from my admittedly limited personal experience, I can always tell you it's because of some competing interest, a producer or a director or film or whatever. You know, stupid people are not making these films. But from Jyn Erso's great triumphant discussion of hope and the suicide attack, you really get the sense that the theme of this film was supposed to be hope. And consequently, if the skeptic doesn't believe that they can do it, and then his blind friend manages to use the Force before dying, then that gives Shirut the motivation to go through with some other part of the mission that he had previously dismissed as not possible. And then you've got a nice little domino character effect there, where one person proves to the other that it is possible. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And that makes sense. And it does seem, I can see how hope would have been meant to be a through line in this film. In a lot of ways, even tying into the retcon title for the original Star Wars movie, A New Hope. It would all tie together. But you're right. What I see on screen, at least with those two characters, I don't see as a reason for hope. I see it as having been let down, that they were intending to go for hope. But since you don't actually see him using the Force to pull the switch, it doesn't look like he's had some kind of breakthrough in his abilities. Mm-hmm. I think we're left with, well, where is his friend getting the hope from? It looks like a brave, self-sacrificing moment in a battle, but not sure. Hope.
Right. But that's what all character arcs are ultimately about. Not necessarily a breakthrough on the part of the character. The character may even be dumb, deaf, and blind for the entire film, but at least for the audience, there's a revelation or a decision. And yeah, I don't think that those characters make one. I don't think that many characters do. Let's move on. If you said all you have to say about the characters in general, because what's interesting about film commentary to me is commenting on something. And honestly, one of the big problems with the film is just that there's not much there. When a character is as one note and uninteresting as General Krennic Krennic, I don't know. It's disappointing, but it's also not worth talking about. I just don't know what to say about him. He wants to have more power, but he's not particularly witty. He's not interesting. He doesn't have any tics. He's just got that, that vaguely British snotty attitude that Americans have been taking exception to ever since the days of the Redcoats, and that's it.
Yeah, I will say director Krennic, his introduction at the beginning of the movie was one of the few points that I actually did enjoy, in that we see him striding magnificently through the field as he heads to Galen Erso's home, cape billowing out grandly behind him. And then we get the initial conversation, and Krennic comes off as snotty, but in a very juvenile, immature way. Grand Moff Tarkin is snotty, but he's snotty in a very menacing, threatening fashion. Krennic is almost like he intends to that level of snottiness, but he's not there. He's just petty. He's a bully, and he's got a couple of troopers beside him with guns to enforce whatever he says, and he's just there on a power trip, picking up a friend who doesn't want to be involved, but well, it doesn't matter what you want. I'm in charge now. And I did like that view of the Empire that, sure, we have the Tarkins, and we have the Emperors, and we have the Vaders that are just evil. It's just who they are. They ooze evilness. And then we've got a whole secondary tier of power in the Empire that they're just petty bullies, and they're enjoying their position. And I did think it was refreshing bringing that into the story and having a character who's not evil in his own right. He's just not nice.
I like the idea of middle management in the Empire, too, but I can't say that I detected as much change in tone than you. The only defining characteristic for Krennic for me was his power relative to other characters, Darth Vader, Tarkin, and so on. I think it would have been more interesting to me if he was clearly lower on the chain of command and that he faced difficulties related to that. It would have been interesting seeing a Imperial officer who kind of had to work for a living.
Right. And to be clear, the only good part about Krennic in his portrayal is that first 5 minutes in the film, his first 5 minutes on screen. Once we get to older Krennic, as the Death Star is being completed, he's not nearly as much fun. We get 5 minutes of what I think of as fun, snooty Krennic, and then the rest is just a Grand Moff Tarkin wannabe. And it actually prompts me to wonder if, in fact, in a more perfect universe, there wouldn't have been a Krennic. It would have been Grand Moff Tarkin from beginning to end. But given that we had to work with a CGI recreation of Tarkin, it was deemed perhaps better to have a fully human actor to carry the main part of the story.
Could be. For me, he's just a gaping hole. We love characters who love something else, who want something. And once again, I guess it was just too, it was all just too abstract for me. But I have been remiss in saying we should move on for the characters, because I think we at least owe credit where credit is due. K2SO is a wonderful creation. And
once again, it's the droids that save the movies.
Yeah, and it's strange. It's like Alan Tudyk had written into his contract that he would have a separate writer from the rest of the film or something, like Jim Carrey, because almost all of his lines made me laugh, and there was literally only one line that I liked in the entire rest of the film. There's a point at which the blind rebel Baze says, "Seriously, I'm blind." I thought that was mildly funny, because they go ahead and put a bag over his head. But that was it. But otherwise, it's the K2SO show from beginning to end. And so when he dies, him alone, I was a little sad.
You know, it's interesting that you point that out. His character in a movie that is epitomized by war-weary, embittered, cynical rebels. It is K2SO, the reprogrammed Imperial droid, who shows more actual bitterness and cynicism than anyone else in the entire film.
Mm. And here again, we see where hope should have played a role. It's obvious that K2SO's constant reminder of what the odds are is a commentary on how hopeless the whole situation is. And the point should have been that it didn't matter. And I don't know if K2SO necessarily needs to have that revelation because he's a droid. He is by nature almost unchangeable. But I don't recall, maybe there was, but I don't recall a moment where that was flagged.
No, I don't think it was. And it didn't feel like the rest of the characters were particularly hopeful in contrast to K2SO, which if you're going to have hope as your through line in the movie, I would think you would want to have, here's the droid that never sees the ray of light shining through the persistent gloom, but here's at least one or two of the other characters who do, who can find that ray of light and hone in on it. And I never quite get that feeling that the rest of them genuinely feel hope. They've got a goal, they've got a plan, they've got a mission, but not that they necessarily have hope.
Right. We didn't need an Iron Giant moment, although that would have been fine, you know, where the young hopeful human teaches the droid a lesson or explains something to him, you know, in the Iron Giant, guns hurt people. In K2SO's case, you know, the odds don't matter. But anyway, I can't really hold any ill will against it in this case because it was the bright shining spot in the film for me. K2SO is kind of the Marvin, the paranoid android of the Star Wars universe.
And how nice it was to finally see Marvin get the big screen performance that he deserved.
Yeah, I mean, you can't fault the casting in the Hitchhiker's Guide. He had the right voice, RIP, but I was left a little unhappy myself. Okay, so that's characters. Mind if we move on to structure a bit?
Yeah, let's go with structure.
All right, because I know that you had some comments about this. The big one for me is that you don't have to do it this way, but essentially Rogue One is a heist movie. And heist movies depend largely on the audience knowing what the plan is in advance so that they can feel the tension when things don't go well and are constantly wondering, are they going to be able to get inside the data center? Are they going to be able to get up the hill? Oh no, they sounded the alarm. How will that affect things? In this case, the whole plan seems as off the cuff as when Luke Skywalker and Han Solo rescue Leia in the first movie. And consequently, it's a battle with a lot of bangs. And if for some reason you do care about these characters, then maybe you're worried about them. But all of that setup is missing from the film.
I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but I'm thinking about it now. And that does make a lot of sense. Their entire plan seems to be, let's go to Scarif in a stolen shuttle and then see what happens. Which, as a plan to attack a heavily guarded Imperial base, seems a little bit short on the actual planning.
Right. I don't even think, did they show us an outline of the station? Like, okay, the data is here, and so we're going to land here. I can't remember if we saw like a hologram of what the station looked like, so we had a physical idea of the base.
No, their plan was pretty much to land. You guys blow a bunch of crap up on the outside and cause a diversion, and we'll slip inside and try to find a map to where the stolen or soon-to-be-stolen tapes are, and then make it up as we go along. And that's pretty much what they do. They go inside, they have K2SO jack in and pull up a map of where they need to go, and then they proceed to go there. But they don't actually have any advance information on how it's set up.
Yeah, see, that, as a writer, I don't understand. And it's especially concerning how many things that don't need to be in the movie are there. It's just odd. You mentioned in some of your notes that I was looking over earlier that, and I noticed this in the beginning of the film. How many planets do they go to? How many cutscenes are there to entirely new areas? It got to where my wife and I actually commented on it and laughed to each other. And a good writing is a lot like engineering, really. You know, you whittle away whatever is unnecessary. You keep things as streamlined as possible, because otherwise you start getting whiplash.
Yeah. I've always admired the first Star Wars movie because it felt to me like a movie that had three main portions. We've got Tatooine with Luke and the droids and getting off of Tatooine with Han Solo. And then we move from there to the Death Star, where we've got lots of running through corridors, shooting, hiding, excitement, and whatnot to rescue the princess. And then we get off of the Death Star, and we go to Yavin, where we have a giant set piece battle in space. And you can pretty much break it down into those are the three main segments of the movie. Each segment holds together and is genuinely entertaining on its own, and each segment contributes to the overall whole.
Let me add to that real quick. The important thing there, that the original movie is very streamlined in that all of those segments begin at the same point. You don't need to introduce three different casts or three different situations, which would really slow things down. Everyone is introduced in the first segment, and then any new people, like, for example, Luke Skywalker himself, come into play as one of those storylines unfurls.
And they come into place in a completely organic way in the story. We need a way to get off of the planet. Here's a pilot. This pilot becomes a main character through the entire rest of the movie. We don't introduce characters just for the sake of introducing characters.
Yeah, as for the sake of introducing action figures, maybe.
Right. So I've always admired that about the first movie. And this one, like I said, we jump around to so many locations. And we introduce the whole Saw Gerrera subplot, which I think could have been excised completely without losing anything, and with, in fact, gaining a great deal of clarity. We introduce the hunt for Galen Erso, which, had it been handled better, could have been the middle part of the movie, with a bit more usefulness. Like, for instance, Galen Erso, if that whole segment had been written better, could have provided a lot of information on Scarif. One assumes he would have visited at least once to pull plans or to place plans for something or other. And so besides just having him say, "I had a technical readout of the Death Star," he could say, "Here's what you need to do, here's where you need to go, here's what you need to be concerned about." Not a full and complete plan, but enough information that the characters themselves could later construct a plan. But instead, we kill him off. We kill him off essentially before Jen Erso ever re-meets him. He dies 30 seconds later in her arms. So we lose that whole source of information. But we've got a movie that jumps around all over the place, with very little structure as to how it goes. And then the entire final third of the movie is where they just put the copy machine on high and pulled in everything else from the previous Star Wars movies. But it was all a jumble.
Yeah, fun story. My wife, at least, went into the movie not knowing what the premise was. So she actually thought the Death Star was yet another Death Star. And she was even more appalled until she realized the story was taking place in the past. So she was pleasantly surprised by some of the developments in the film. And since she didn't know about the premise, she got surprised by Grand Moff Tarkin. She got surprised by Leia and Darth Vader. And that went some way to helping her opinion of the film, although I really don't think that's a common experience for people. I think most of them probably know what they're going to get here.
I would tend to agree, but yes, I could see those moments of surprise making the film overall seem a little bit better, especially when you realize that, yes, you're not dealing with a third Death Star, although that would be a completely reasonable conclusion to come to after we already had two Death Stars and then some kind of Sun Killer device.
Right. So we've enumerated for 45 minutes why we don't like this film, and we have pretty good reasons for it. And if you were to go into any screenwriting class, I think, or if you were to talk to any director, I think they would tell you that you're not supposed to do these things this way. So my question isn't really how things got screwed up, because A, we have no way of knowing exactly, and B, it's always the same story in the end. But what is this collective mentality that praises this film so highly? I kind of understood the last movie because, yes, as unoriginal as it was, all the other values were top-notch. The dialogue was fine. The moments were really cool. And I looked around. Every face in the theater smiled when Han Solo appeared on screen again. Just the reservoir of goodwill was as deep as the Mariana Trench. So I can understand why everyone enjoyed that film, and I even enjoyed it. After I noticed what was happening, but to be honest, I had a decent time. But this film just seems irredeemable to me, and it's nevertheless being praised to the heavens, which is kind of crazy-making. So my question is, what's going on here? Why is everyone else entertained, and why are you not entertained?
I've seen people praising it because its action sequences are homages to older films, and not just older films in the Star Wars canon, but older films in general, older Westerns. And I don't have the depth of movie knowledge and movie history to agree or disagree with those statements, but I've seen that as a reason to like the movie. I think there's also a segment of people who are just excited that it's a Star Wars movie. It's our second new Star Wars movie in as many years, and it's good to see Star Wars back on the big screen, especially back on the big screen on a regular basis. So I think that drives some of the excitement as well, and I think the space battles on a really superficial level and the surface shootouts are fun. There's explosions, there's AT-AT walkers, there's Imperial shuttles, there's TIE fighters, there's X-Wings, there's Star Destroyers, there's Corvettes. It's all very familiar and on a surface level very exciting. I think where you and I are coming from is just looking at the movie from a deeper perspective, and I think both of us wanting, perhaps more than most people do, wanting something new in the Star Wars universe rather than something remixed and familiar. And I think maybe that's part of what it comes down to. Is a lot of people like having a remix of the familiar and the comfortable and don't even necessarily notice that they're not getting something new.
So it's nostalgia, really, is the drive here. And I guess if there's enough fans, then the rest, that I think there's probably a critical momentum that gets achieved there. You probably know the story of how allegedly a certain number of a minority really doomed New Coke. Those psychology studies that suggest that if there is a loud and vocal minority, that they kind of lead the pack if they're more passionate. Maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe Star Wars is just so fondly remembered. Maybe it's just new, and after we have another four films, one every year, then people are going to be tired of it. I'll admit that part of it may just be that Star Wars in and of itself as a concept no longer excites me, which is not to say I don't love Star Wars stories. It's weird that while watching this movie or in the same time period, I was also really enjoying some of the Marvel comics that are being put out now about Star Wars. The Darth Vader series, which concluded fairly recently, is just a really good time. So I'm open to it. I'm certainly not prejudiced against it. I don't know how people can be at Star Wars, but it doesn't add points to the overall scorecard for me anymore.
I will agree with that. For me, it really does come down to, is it new? Is it interesting? And are the characters interesting? And as we've discussed at length, the characters were not interesting. They were hard to keep track of more than anything else. And I'll admit to being more into the movie until we got to the attack on Scarif. Once we hit the attack on Scarif and the action starts happening and the people from the shuttle sucker some Imperial guards into getting close enough to get shot so they can steal their uniforms. And I think, oh no, here we go again. It's the Millennium Falcon on board the Death Star taking the Stormtrooper uniforms. And then we move into a whole base sequence that getting into the base is taken from the battle on Endor, and moving through the base is taken from the Death Star action sequences. And then all of the Rebel fleet pops out of hyperspace above Scarif, and that whole sequence starts looking exactly like the Battle of Endor over the moon in front of the Death Star. At that point, it felt like a very, not even paint by numbers, or maybe paint by numbers. You can see, here's exactly what's going to happen in the whole rest of this movie. All that's left is to just paint in the colors with your water brush. And I totally lost interest at that point, because there ceased to be any element of suspense. There ceased to be any expectation of surprise. It was just, oh wait, I've seen this, in fact, two or three times, or given that I grew up watching these movies, I've seen this 20 or 30 times. I could walk out of the theater right now and not feel like I was missing anything. And that was the point at which I changed from, this movie is confusing, to, I hate this movie, and I don't like the people who put it together.
Well, give them one piece of credit. They did come up with a setting for another battle that I hadn't thought of. I was wondering what they were going to do, since they'd already been forced to use desert planets twice within 2 years. But hey, palm trees, a beach, water, that's brilliant. It's worth noting that your daughter's had a decent time, right? We have to remember that our prior experience does color our understanding of these films. Although really, with a film that relies so much on nostalgia for the first movie, how can it not? I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to watch these films if you haven't seen A New Hope. Although my brother's girlfriend can probably tell me. Because they went, and she had never seen a Star Wars film before, and they started with Rogue One. The mind boggles.
There are so many things wrong with that scenario right from the beginning that one doesn't even know where to start.
It got worse from there, actually. My brother's girlfriend saw Rogue One, thought it was okay, but felt like she was probably missing something, and then decided to go back and watch the rest of the movie, starting, of course, with episode one.
Oh. Ouch.
Yeah. When she got to episode five, I mean, these things you don't even think of, but, you know, Yoda says, oh, I will take you to the Jedi Master, you know, and starts walking off. And, you know, she's saying, well, what? She,
know? Yes, in retrospect, so many things in that original trilogy were written assuming you had never seen the what would become the prequels, that if you actually watch the movies in chronological order, it ruins a lot of it.
Yeah, I can't see how anyone can argue to the contrary. So many moments fall flat, from Darth Vader saying, I am your father, and onward. Fortunately, she seemed to have missed the... She didn't connect the dots about Luke and Leia being siblings until about when everyone else did, which is after you've enjoyed the movies.
Probably by that point in Revenge of the Sith, you'd just gotten numb from the wooden acting that finer details just start passing over your head entirely.
Yeah, she's probably just watching them all thinking, well, my boyfriend likes them. I don't know why, but I'm going to put up with it. There's, they have a... like, good girlfriends everywhere.